tonight we're going to be dealing with not Esther as the way of cross as a way of life, because that's what we dealt with last time, but rather Esther chapter 5 and Esther chapter 6. And so the title of tonight's class is going to be God is at work behind every shadow, and that's from what we're going to see in Esther chapter 5. And then we'll go on to Esther chapter 6 and we'll talk about the great reversal, particularly between the roles of Haman and Mordecai. And then finally, our class next week will consider Esther 7 and Esther chapters 8 and 9 to conclude with. Okay, so Esther chapter 4. We learnt last week of that Mordecai brought Esther to the cross. And the context, of course, was that the king's decree to approve what Haman had requested to kill a certain group of people that the king didn't even know who they were. It was genocide in one day. All the Jews were going to be killed. And so Mordecai was absolutely devastated. He tore his clothes, he put on sackcloth and ashes, and he made a scene such that Esther was very concerned. And so we learned this conversation between Esther and Mordecai happened between a person by the name, a medium, who was Esther's servant. His name was Hattach, and it means the truth. And so Esther initially called Hattach to inquire why Mordecai was making such a scene and bringing shame upon her. Mordecai responded back, explaining what Haman had done and the decree. Evidently, Esther didn't know anything about it. And he asks Esther to go before the king. But Esther wasn't prepared initially. In a second response back to Mordecai, through Hattach, she said, "Look, I could die. I can't do that. I haven't been in before the king, and if he doesn't hold out the scepter for me, there's a great risk that I could lose my life." Then Mordecai responded back saying, "Well, think about this, okay? Don't think of all the Jews, okay? And that doing nothing will not help, will not even help yourself. And think about that God could be using you now, right now, for such a time as this." And so finally in verses 15 to 16, in her third response, she accepted Mordecai's suggestion. She changed her way of thinking. She was trusting in God, requested prayer and fasting, and then Mordecai carried out her instruction. So again, what was amazing in this whole chapter, chapter 4, was to note that there was no personal contact between Mordecai or Esther. This dramatic conversation all occurred via a messenger by the name of Hattach, whose name means truth. And that's what the message was all about. It was the message of truth that Esther came to accept, and it was the way of the cross. And so we particularly noted that Esther just didn't make a light decision, "Okay, I'm going to go in before the king tomorrow." No, in verse 15 and 16 of chapter 4, we read that Esther asked to gather all the Jews together that are present in Shushan, okay, and fast for me. So it wasn't just her and her maidens that would fast, but she asked the help of all the Jews in Shushan to help her out. And they were going to fast like that for 3 days, okay, before going into the king. So there was a lot of preparation, obviously in prayer to God. But for herself, her answer was well thought out, because what she was about to do, which was willing to lay down the life for others, the way of the cross, cannot be taken up on the basis of emotion or a quick decision. Serious preparation is necessary, and it needs the help of our brethren and sisters, our ecclesia, of others. She changed from fear to faith, from hesitation to determination, from concern about her own personal safety to concern for her people's survival. She'd now reached the stage that Mordecai was in chapter 3. Haman must be defiled, even at the risk of her life. And so that statement, "If I perish, I perish," we said it's not, you know, a fatalistic type of statement. It's a declaration of her faith, not her despair. She's now ready to perish if necessary to keep others from perishing. And so now we come to chapter 5 tonight. In light of what we will discover in this chapter, momentous issues also hang on and unexpected invitations and sleepless nights in a king's palace. And so that's why God is at work. We're going to see that God is at work behind every shadow. Nothing happened by chance. And Esther would finally discover that for herself. So her 3-day fast and prayer was now completed. It was time for her to act. And when she did, some breathtaking twists and turns followed closely on the heels of her action. So let's read, David, Esther chapter 5 and verse 1, please.
Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, across from the king's house, while the king sat on his royal throne in the royal house, facing the entrance of the house.
Thanks. So this could be the last day of her life. There's no guarantee or divine indication that her request will be heeded. We don't have any record of some prophet answering and say, God has heard your prayer and he will be with you. Nothing like that. And she's going to use her position as queen to appeal to the king. But obviously she could lose a position. And she, not only that, not only her honor as queen, but she's putting her life at risk, just as Mordecai did. But importantly, she's got her priorities right. God and his people come first. What was most important to her now was her eternal crown, not her earthly crown. And so there's a great lesson for us in that faith isn't just a mental or a passive outlook, just to say, yeah, we believe, you know, and we can say that or we can mentally agree with it. But practically, we have to put it into practice, our faith. At times, we literally have to walk the steps of our faith. Put it into action, as Esther did. And so in chapter 5 and verse 2, it says, and it was so when the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, that she obtained favor in his sight. It seems like it was too easy. And I don't think she would have expected this, that the king immediately responded with favor. Why did Ahasuerus interrupt the business of his court to hear Esther's request? I mean, you don't just walk or waltz into the king's court and announce that your agenda is more important than his. But from Ahasuerus' perspective, it looks like that nothing was more important to him than Esther. Now, the Septuagint version of this chapter adds some additional commentary, which is interesting to read. It's a bit more dramatic, it's a bit more romantic, if you like, but it's interesting. And here's what it says. Esther's heart was pounding with fear, and when she had passed through all the doors, she stood before the king. Raising his face, flushed with colour, the king looked at her in his fiercest anger. The queen stumbled, turned pale, and fainted. He, the king, sprang from his throne in alarm and took her up in his arms until she revived and comforted her with reassuring words. So maybe this sounds more reasonable, sounds more realistic as to what could have happened, but it is a little bit like a fairy tale, isn't it? But nevertheless, the truth is that Ahasuerus responded favorably to Esther's presence. And what actually occurred is amazing. And the record tells us what happened next. So continuing in verse 2, we read that he held out the scepter, out to Esther, the golden scepter that was in his hand. And then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is it, Esther, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, even to half of my kingdom." So the good news of the scepter was that instead of killing her, the king was allowing her to live. And an even greater surprise, of course, was that he didn't even rebuke her for the intrusion. He didn't say, what on earth are you doing? Can't you see I'm busy? What is it? Okay, I'll listen to you. What do you want? No. She received not only the king's pardon, but evidently a measure of respect. No doubt it's her character once again that the king knows and trusts her. And that's the reason the king welcomes her, to the extent of promising to grant her whatever she wants, up to half of the kingdom. Now, most women would be overwhelmed in her position, but they'd lose touch with spiritual reality. We can understand how a 90-year-old brother, well experienced in life, would be prepared to sacrifice his life for others. But here was a 25-year-old sister who had the world at her fingertips, yet who was willing to give it all up for the sake of the people. And so the king responded with great favour. He was willing to grant her anything she wanted, up to half of the kingdom. As I suggested last week, one possible reason, maybe Esther had his children. Okay, and he knew giving anything to Esther would go to his children as well. And so Esther responded by saying, if it please the king, let the king Haman, king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king. And so Esther now had a golden opportunity before everyone. Remember, she's facing the whole court. Everyone's there. Haman's there. Every official that's important before the king. Everyone's there. She had a golden opportunity to state the case, to state what the problem was, to reveal how the wicked plot of Haman before everyone. But she didn't take it. Instead, she said, look, I'd like to invite you to a feast. Evidently, she'd modified her strategy during the 3 days of fasting. Okay, it was obvious to her. She'd worked out a plan to do that. Remember, Mordecai commanded her to go and see the king, but he also asked her to use her cunning, to use her strategy, to use her persuasion before the king. And this is exactly what Esther was doing. And more importantly, perhaps God had provoked in her a different plan to do things privately, to lure the king and Haman away from the press, the media, the public. Everyone was there. Because embarrassment would naturally arise if she stated what had gone on before everyone. And when the king realized that he actually signed a death warrant for his own wife, okay, that would be a very publicly embarrassing thing for the king. And it also, by luring the king away, it would make it easy for the king to think more rationally and to save Esther and her people. And so, why invite Haman, though? Why not just herself and the king? Well, I think this was a stroke of genius. By inviting Haman to come with the king, Esther knew that it would quell any suspicion that was aroused in Haman. If Esther just requested a meeting with the king alone, Haman would have asked himself, well, why is the queen just risked her life to invite her husband to dinner? He would have suspected that the queen was up to something and tried to find out what the secret was. Instead, his ego was so inflated by this special invitation of a banquet of just the three of them, the king, Esther, and him, that any thoughts of suspicion never crossed his mind. Okay, so let's read how the king responds next in verses 5 and 6. David, if you could read this, please.
Then the king said, bring Haman quickly, that he may do as Esther has said. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. At the banquet of wine, the king said to Esther, what is your petition? it shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half my kingdom. It shall be done.
So again, the king knew that it was really important. He knew that Esther had risked her life to come in before him, and it was obvious to the king that whatever she wanted to say was really important. And so he now requests Esther to come out with it. What's the problem? So this was the moment, wasn't it, that Esther was waiting for. But let's see how Esther responds. Continue reading, please, David, in verses 7 and 8.
Then Esther answered and said, "My petition and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to the banquet, which I will prepare for them. And tomorrow I will do as the king has said."
Okay, so another feast. I mean, okay, we understood why before on the first request, she removed this conversation from the press and the media and all the public and just made it privately. Now she's in that private circumstance. Why does she delay things again by requesting another feast tomorrow? Why not just spit it out there and then? Well, the first suggestion is that perhaps Esther choked in front of the king and the Haman. You know, there's the king and the equivalent of Hitler sitting across the table. Terribly intimidating. Okay? He was the cold-blooded enemy of her people. And certainly she was terrified throughout the meal and probably struggled to somehow appear happy and, well, normal. But, okay, that's one suggestion. Another suggestion is that it's a manipulative ploy on the part of Esther. Okay, so she's being manipulative. If it pleased the king to grant my wish, she's trying to get the king to agree to whatever it was she wanted before he even knew what it was. That doesn't stack up to me because the king had already offered her anything she wanted, up to half the kingdom. She didn't need another meal to nail it down. And she was actually risking making the king upset by delaying her request another day. But anyway, I believe that the answer is it was God's providence that was causing her to delay. God was about to direct circumstances in ways Esther could have never imagined over the course of one very sleepless night. And it was God's plan that she should wait to share her secret with the king. Events were taking place beyond Esther's power and knowledge. You see, if Esther delayed her request by one day, it would be too late for Mordecai. Because Haman was going to kill Mordecai the next morning. But she didn't know that. She didn't know that Haman was going to kill Mordecai the next morning, planning to do that, before she had an opportunity to finally spit out a request. But God knew about this, and he was able to deal with this. So the story is filled with people who continually try to plot and scheme their will into existence, but all along, God is weaving their schemes into his purpose of redemption. And so the book of Esther is not it's illustrating that the book of Esther is not a revelation of how clever people are. It's a dramatic demonstration of how clever God is. Haman was very excited about this. He was ecstatic about this and he went out. But he met Mordecai in the way. Let's read this, please. David, Esther, chapter 5, verses 9 and 10.
So Haman went out that day, joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh.
So note that Mordecai is no longer in sackcloth and ashes, like when we talked about him last class. Now he's back inside the king's gate. Okay, he's in his official uniform. He's back at his desk again. But Haman comes by and Mordecai refuses to bow down to Haman. So he effectively insulted Haman, the prime minister, in front of all the palace officials. And this would be sufficient to warrant Mordecai's death. And it's on that basis then that the king, the very next morning, Haman was then going to push for Mordecai's death before the king. Now, at this point, Haman restrained himself because, as it says, he went out that day joyful and glad of heart. So his temporary state of great joy exceeded his permanent hatred of Mordecai. Again, why did Mordecai refuse to bow down to Haman? And this is the same as chapter 3, verse 2, where Mordecai did not bow, nor did he pay homage to Haman. It wasn't just anyone. Okay? Mordecai knew his Bible. Haman represented, okay, the head of a group of people who God had declared must be destroyed. Agag, the king of the Amalekites. That's who he represented. Because otherwise, they would destroy God's people. Possibly Mordecai had knew of or had overheard Haman's intention to try and kill all the Jews. And this is what he objected so strongly to. And his refusal to bow reveals his spiritual courage and his character. The easiest path would have been the path of least resistance, just to quietly go along with the king's command, bow down to Haman, not to make a fuss. But Mordecai could not do that. He could not submit to such a man who was intent on destroying God's people. And so there's a lesson here. And the most important thing is that God is taking out of the Gentiles a people for his name. We have to stand up for the truth, not be silent. We have to preach it out loud, preach it to our children, preach it to others, give them the hope of eternal life, okay? Not to quietly go along and muzzle ourselves in life and cause no trouble with others. We have to be prepared. It's going to cause trouble with some, but hopefully it'll reap the benefit of eternal life for others. So we have to resist any form of policy, any form of pressure, could even come from the government or teaching, that will remove the possibility of us, our children, having the hope of eternal life in our ecclesia. We have to stand up for God's truth. And a reminder that Haman nature is human nature. Okay? Through Haman, God is teaching us about king sin, the diabolos. How king sin thinks, how he assumes, how he plans, how he makes decisions, how he takes action. The diabolos is in us all. So we have to be careful and we have to be aware of this. And we have to put it to death. So then Haman went to his family and recounted in jubilation, absolute ecstaticment. He boasted to his family about the current position he thought he was in. David, verses 11 and 12, please.
Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, all the ways in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared, and tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king.
Okay, so Haman brought together his wife Zeresh and the rest of his companions to tell them yet again why the king admired him so much, why Persia just wouldn't be the same without him, without his leadership, and how he'd been invited to dine with the king and the queen. Yada, yada, yada. You see, Haman was like the legendary Greek character, Narcissus, right, who loved his own reflection more than anything else. He was so enamored of himself that he became the object of his own devotion. That was Narcissus. And so it was true with Haman. The world, Haman's world, revolved around him. Haman was one big hot air balloon. He was self-conceited, self-promoting, self-applauding, and self-absorbed. But as I said, there's a warning here, because this is the diabolos in us all. And Haman, or the flesh, wants more. In verse 13, we read that Haman said, "Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." So deep down, he's still unhappy. He's got 99 things, but he wants 100. And this is what the diabolos, our own nature, does to us. What we haven't got consumes us and prevents us from being content with what we do have. And so the truth is, we're a lot more like Haman than we want to admit. So think about it. Who is our favorite person to please? What's our favorite topic of conversation? The person we think who is most deserving of love and admiration. So Haman's craving for one more thing here would be his undoing. And it could be ours as well. We are our greatest roadblock to contentment. Philippians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4. "Do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others to be more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others." Then in verse 14, we come to the lowest point in the book of Esther. David, please.
"Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, 'Let a gallows be made 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet.' And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made."
Thank you. So remember that neither Esther nor Mordecai knew anything about this. And therefore, Mordecai would have been arrested and hanged in the morning, well before Esther's next dinner party. The first thing, Haman was going to go to the king in the morning and tell about Mordecai's disgraceful behavior, insulting behavior, and seek to push for his death. That's what he was going to do the first thing next morning. And that would have ruined Esther's plan. And it would have meant she should have already spilled out the problem at the first banquet rather than delaying things by 24 hours or so. Now, the Persian gallows, as you can see here from a historical relief of the picture at the time, they weren't like a Ned Kelly gallows with a loop and hanging around the neck that you know we think about when Ned Kelly was hung on or someone else, what we think of a gallows. It was basically a large spike, a sharpened pole at the top, where they were impaled, and typically they were raised on a platform or a hillside. Now, Zeresh recommended that the gallows be 50 cubits high. And just just before I say that, I should have said that in the Hebrew, "let him make a gallows," the Hebrew is a tree or wood. "Let him make a tree or a wood" is the Hebrew. The NIV and the ISV have a pole set up. So what Jerry suggested, that the gallows be 50 cubits, is about 22.5 meters, or a seven-story building. So it would have been a raised platform with this long spike on top. And so it was a high point everyone would see. And this would be a high point for Haman. Everyone would know of Haman's power. If you don't bow down to Haman, this is what's going to happen to you. But it was the lowest point in the drama of Esther. Okay? God seems to have completely abandoned his people. The things never looked worse. Mordecai was a dead man. God had to do something that very night. And that is exactly what happened. And so we read about that in chapter 6, where we learn of the great reversal between Haman and Mordecai. So verses 1 and 2 of chapter 6, let's read that please, David.
That night the king could not sleep, so one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus.
Okay, I love this scene. Here's the king in his bedroom that night, and he simply could not fall asleep. He read the newspaper, he read Strong's Concordance, he tried, you know, counting sheep, you know, he'd gone through every boring magazine possible, but nothing worked. So he ordered the Chronicles of Persia to be read to him. Now, the Chronicles of Persia, it's like reading, would be like reading through the records of Parliament today. Among the thousands of scrolls, okay, there was picked a 5-year-old scroll that mentioned Mordecai. So this accomplished two very important things. First of all, it reminded the king about Esther's loyalty and placed Mordecai in a favourable light. And it made him feel very embarrassed. He'd made a big blunder, because he goes on to say in verse 3, and the king said, "What honour or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." Well, the king would have been aghast. You know, that's totally out of character with the practice of Persian kings, including Ahasuerus himself. It's normal to reward such faithful citizens who'd saved the king's life with jewelry, with garments or property. For example, Cyrus had given a loyal general a horse with a solid gold bridle and a dagger, along with a beautiful Persian robe. And there's a record of Ahasuerus himself rewarding noble servants as well. He'd already gifted a faithful admirals with plots of land, and he'd made one faithful man the governor of a region as a reward for saving the king's brother's life. So now he's embarrassed that nothing has been done for Mordecai. Such loyal people were also given a special title, the king's benefactors. So the king knew that Mordecai was a Jew, but he had no idea that he had been condemned to death. That what Haman had asked for and he'd signed was basically the condemnation of all the Jews. And remember that in Esther 3, Haman never identified the people to be killed as the Jews. Haman wrote the decree and signed it himself with a king's seal. Perhaps the king was just too busy, too many things to sign. And he was blinded by the offer of money that Haman was proposing that would be associated with this deal, because all the wealth of the Jews would go into the king's treasury. Now, just at this juncture, Haman turns up in the morning. Remember? He just finished building the gallows that night, probably took all night to do, okay? And he was simply too excited to sleep. So he decided to go to work early in anticipation of his best day ever. He was about to be rid of the one man left in the nation who refused to venerate him. And he also had another dinner reservation with the king and the queen. Haman's hot air balloon was sailing higher than cloud 9. And so we read of him coming in. He came in at that point. So let's read Now, from verse 6 to 8, please, David.
So Haman came in, and the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "Well, whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on his head."
Yeah, thank you. So obviously Haman thought the king was speaking about him, that the king would honor Haman, delight to honor him. And we think, well, how did Haman come up with this list so quickly? It wasn't as if Haman just, this might be a good idea, or how about this, or you could do this. It was a very specific instruction. This is what you've got to do. For the man who the king delights to honor, bring royal robes. Not any royal robes, but the robes which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a crown is set, and so forth. So it was a very specific plan. He'd already thought long and hard about how he would like to be honored in public. And it included wearing the king's robe, his crown, and riding his horse too. I guess it's like the Queen of England offering not just to pay for your first class ticket to travel to England to visit her, but instead sending her private jet, her very own latest 2021 model luxury private jet to Sydney to take you specifically to ride in that to go and visit her. So, you know, as the Prime Minister, Haman had enjoyed everything but the throne. He had plenty of money, power, prestige, but you see, he wasn't the king. So he just didn't want to be treated well by the king for the afternoon. He wanted to be treated as if he was the king himself. And so that's why he wanted to wear the king's own robe and ride on have the king's crown on his head and ride on the king's horse. So that's the point there. He wanted to be treated as if he is the king. And Middle Eastern culture, the garments expressed who you were, the garments that you wore. So we can think about that. Aaron's, in the Bible, Aaron's priestly garments were given to his son. It's a title of, it signifies exactly who they are if you're wearing the priestly garments. Elijah received Elisha's mantle or cloak that was passed on. The sign of a prophet. Now it was obvious to all that Elisha would do what Elijah was formerly doing. One more example, we know that the people spread their garments on the road for Jesus to ride over. Okay, so the garments are very important, and doing that is submitting to Jesus, giving honor to him. So as far as Haman was concerned, this was truly turning out to be the best day of his life. But what happened next turned Haman's dreams to ashes. So if you can read verses 10, 11, and 12, David, please.
Then the king said to Haman, "Hasten, take the robe and the horse as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken." So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, "Thus it shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hastened to his house, mourning and with his head covered.
So you can imagine Haman thinking, "What? Are you kidding me? Mordecai, the Jew, I've got to do this to?" And the Hebrew indicates that Haman was himself required to do it all. He personally had to do all of this, and he couldn't get out of it. And so here we have a pivotal point in both men's lives, a decisive moment in this great drama For Haman, it was a crushing blow. He quickly returned home to change clothes and get ready for dinner back at the palace. He was in mourning. But for Mordecai, it was elation. It was elevation. And so his wife and his friends, Haman's wife and his friends regathered. And instead of comforting, they gave him an ominous warning that we read in the next two verses. David, could you please read that again, verse 13 and 14?
When Haman told his wife, Zeresh, and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wife, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him." While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman to the banquet, which Esther had prepared.
So rather than comforting Haman or suggesting a counter strategy, Zeresh and Haman's friends give an ominous warning. Before it was his wife Zeresh that suggested to Haman to build the gallows. Now she's saying something ominous. You better look out. Okay. And how did she know that Haman was ruined? She said, if Mordecai began, now that you've begun to fall, and he's of the Jews, I think you're going to fail. You're going to fall. How did she know that? Well, I think it's a recognition that if God was blessing the Jews, then they would be cursed. And I think also these Zeresh and wise men knew from history what had happened, and its recent history as well, with Daniel and the lion's den, okay, based on that Ahasuerus is the same Ahasuerus a little bit earlier on in Daniel chapter 6 in time, that they knew about the Jews that had plotted Daniel, the Jews that tried to plot Daniel's death ended up being destroyed themselves. And so that record is in Daniel chapter 6, isn't it? So they tried to, you know, throw Daniel in the lion's den and have him destroyed, and in the end, those people were destroyed themselves. So perhaps this is what Zeresh has got in mind when she's saying, well, look, we better be careful. Effectively, he's saying, look, time to back out. Let's run for the hills while you've got a chance. But in verse 14, she barely got the words out of their mouth before the king's eunuch arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. He couldn't get out of it now. So what an amazing couple of chapters where we've seen God's providence at work. We've seen a queen who risked her life to invite the king to a banquet. We've seen a prime minister who determined to use a hanging to enhance his power. We've seen a queen who delayed making her petition until a second banquet. And then a king who was plagued with insomnia. And a servant who just picked up the right scroll among the thousands to read to the sleepless king. And a hero who had saved the king's life previously, that's Mordecai, but wasn't rewarded until the day he was unknowingly going to be executed. And Haman, a killer at the top of the food chain, who was forced to honor and reward his mortal enemy, the man he had intended to hang. And all of this happened within the space of 12 hours during just one sleepless night. So only God could have arranged the timing of these events. God was moving the pieces of this story with divine precision. He doesn't make a mistake. He anticipates precisely the next move. And we think about that in our lives, that God is at work in our lives, even when circumstances seem uncontrollable. Esther and Mordecai no doubt had heard about the gallows being constructed. They figured out who it was for. But everything was in God's perfect timing. Mordecai's name was brought before the king in a favourable manner. He'd saved the king's life, and this had prepared the king's heart to not only to save Esther, but obviously Mordecai's life as well. God is at work even when life is unpredictable. Can you imagine the roller coaster ride that Mordecai had been on over the past 5 years? Life will, for us, the lesson is life will always be unpredictable, but God is at work. And stability in life never comes from life itself. It comes from trusting the one who gave us life. It doesn't come from how many likes on social media or what other people think about us. Stability in life comes from trusting in God and walking in God's ways. And God is at work even when the diabolos and the power of its death seems unstoppable. Okay, the edict had been written, the law of the Medes and Persians, which meant that it was unchangeable. The Jews were condemned to die, and Haman's family had built a gallows for Mordecai. And the king had yielded his authority to a murderer. So sin was reigning, while sanity had evidently been thrown out the window. And so Christ destroyed, we remember that Christ destroyed human nature. That's what he did in his death. He destroyed, through his own death, he destroyed him that has the power of death, that is the devil. And we've all got that problem. All of our life, we're subject to that fear of death. We're subject to the bondage of the diabolos, the death-stricken state, and the temptation to sin. We can't escape it. But we see here some examples of people willing to stand up and destroy the Amalekites or the problem of the devil. Moses when he was 80 years old, Samuel when he was 90 years old. Here's Mordecai at 90 years old. And as we talked about before, Esther, as a young woman with everything on a plate, materialistically speaking. Of course, Jesus Christ did it completely. John 13, verse 14 to 15. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. But whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. So Agag or Haman was defeated by faith and action. Okay, they didn't know God was going to orchestrate events to their favor. They had to show faith in seemingly impossible circumstances. We can only be victorious over the diabolos in us by our faith and participation in the way God has provided through Jesus Christ. Now, also, we must understand that we live in a world that is very unfavorable towards preaching the truth, don't we? When you think about the diabolos, it's not just ourself, our nature, but it's also political. It's human nature in power, ruling this world in a manner that is antagonistic to God's truth. And it's in every government of the world. All those in position and power of authority, they're corrupt, they're full of lies, they're against the truth of God. And it's seeking to wear us out, making our spiritual life very hard, tempting us and detracting us away from our one true calling. So we have to be aware of this. And that's what the Apostle Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6. I like Weymouth's translation of this passage in Ephesians chapter 6. Put on the complete armor of God so as to be able to stand firm against all the stratagems of the devil, so the diabolos. For ours is not a conflict with mere flesh and blood, but with despotisms, the empires, the forces that control and govern this dark world, the spiritual hosts of evil arrayed against us in the heavenly warfare. Again, we have to have the courage to stand up against this and not just muzzle ourselves and go along with things. There's some comfort here because we know that God is with us. Psalm 34, verse 7 says, "The angel of Yahweh encamps around those who fear and delivers them." And Psalm 121, verse 4, "Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep." And this is another way of saying God never goes off duty. So when we have trouble sleeping, he's awake with us. And when we finally drift off to sleep, God doesn't. God's never tired. We can be, but God never sleeps. And again, Daniel chapter 4, verse 17, again reminds us that that God rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomsoever he will and setteth up over it the basis of men. So the point is, we don't have to be in control of our situation or circumstances because God already is in control. And so the angel, God is working through the angels. Okay, the angels are doing God's bidding all over the world, politically, economically, and even individually, to help us and direct our lives so that ultimately we will get into the kingdom. And that often means suffering and trial along the way. But God's plans and his counter plans and what's going on are moving from his perspective with perfect precision and perfect planning and power, just like what happened here, the right time to reveal for Ahasuerus to have a night of insomnia and to be reminded about what Mordecai did to save his life. God moves in seemingly unfathomable ways. God can make things work. So there's a great exultation in what happened here and with respect to our future appearance before Jesus Christ. Esther risked her life to go in before the king. But we don't have to be a queen, okay, to appear before Jesus Christ and receive eternal life. Because that's what we're going to ask him when he returns. "Please, Lord, grant us, you know, forgive us for our sins and let us, please, have eternal life in your kingdom." Jesus says in Revelation chapter 22, verse 17, "Whosoever will may come." But the point is, we need to have the courage now to die to the world and the faith to believe and follow Christ. So this our appearance before the king. Okay, remember what Esther did. It wasn't easy. And that not easy part is now, the way we live our life. "Now, no one dared to enter the court of a Persian king without being called. But we've been called by a king, haven't we, who holds a righteous scepter." Hebrews chapter 1, verse 8 says, "But of the Son," he says, "a righteous scepter is the scepter of your kingdom." So in actual fact, Jesus is calling us to his kingdom. We're not going, we're not uninvited. We're not going to enter into his presence unannounced. He has invited us to be there. And so as Hebrews 4 verse 16 says, "Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." What comforting words they are. So King Ahasuerus promised Esther that her request would be answered up to half of the kingdom. The Lord Jesus Christ graciously says to those who come in to him in faith, "Whatsoever ye ask in my name, that will I do. And fear not, little flock, it is your Father's pleasure to give you the kingdom." So that concludes our class for tonight. Next week, we'll deal with the final class, which will be Esther chapter 7 and 8 and 9. In Esther chapter 7, we'll see that when finally Esther does reveal her request to the king, make it plain, she doesn't mince words. She's very forthright. She doesn't hold back at all. And then in chapter 8 and chapter 9, the gospel. We'll see the gospel in Esther, the message of light, joy, gladness, and honor. And we're even told that many of the people of the land became Jews at that time. The Persians literally aligned themselves in solidarity alongside the Jews. And the Jews didn't seek to take revenge on their enemies, which is an interesting point we'll see as well.